last time.
Everett, and you're listening to The First Time. Happy Christmas. This is the show where we meet some of the most influential and best-loved musicians around and take a look at the pivotal first musical moments that made them who they are today. And fittingly, as it's Christmas Day, my guest this week is the singer of a band who've succeeded where many have failed in being responsible for a Christmas song that is authentic, excellent, and very firmly part of the festive canon. More of that later. He's also the flamboyant frontman of a rock band who, in the early noughties, rode a wave of enormous success on the back of big riffs, big choruses, his big falsetto, and a big slice of humour. I'm delighted to say my guest on The First Time this week is Justin Hawkins from The Darkness. And you just heard the brilliant Growing On Me from the band's debut album, Permission to Land. And we'll be learning about how the success of that record led to everything from guitar solos on the back of Flying Tigers to Justin leaving the band in order to save himself. Along the way, we'll find out why jukeboxes were an early part of his musical education, how an interpretive dance at the turn of the millennium led to him becoming a lead singer, and we'll also find out about his award-winning previous career writing disco hymns for the Church of England. And we'll find out how his time in rehab built the foundations for The Darkness as they are today. Back playing arenas once again. Happy Christmas, Justin.
Oh, Merry Christmas to you too. Oh.
The first question we always ask everybody is, when were they first aware of music? So, actually, let's start. When were you first aware? What was the first Christmas song you can remember? As this is Christmas Day.
Oh, God. Oh, I reckon it must have been Shaky.
Mm-hmm.
Because I remember the first record, well, the first single that I bought two singles in quick succession, and one of them was Joe Dolce's Shut Up Your Face. And then the other one was This Old House, which I think informed my love of rock and roll. So it probably would have been Shaky's one, because I reckon that's around about the same time as that, wouldn't it be?
Christmas songs. We're gonna have the party tonight. I'm gonna find that girl underneath the mistletoe in the
Let's go back to the first time you were aware of any music then. What would that have been?
Well, in our household, it was mum and dad having parties, you know, so you'd be aware that an occurrence was happening because we'd all be sent to bed and then you'd hear like the bass pumping up through the floorboards. And it would always be Queen, Fleetwood Mac, a bit of Dire Straits, stuff that my mum can sing along to, Fats Domino, and a lot of reggae as well. My mum was well into reggae.
Was music, was it kind of valued as something important in the household, or was it just party music or something on in the background, or was it like, it's time, you should, this is good. Justin, Dan, this is something that you should be paying attention to.
Well, I think, because my mum and dad were like, for a minute they had a pub, and then the thing that they loved the most about the pub was the jukebox. So they're always kind of buying and selling jukeboxes throughout our childhood. My mum thought that the sound of a jukebox was the sound. You know, there was no audiophile stuff happening, or you know, no fancy headphones or expensive speakers or anything. It was always just like a really old jukebox.
Oh, but that's great, though.
Yeah, which they swore was the best sound, you know. But I don't think it was like, there was no ceremony or pageantry around the music. It wasn't sort of lauded as the superior art form, even though we all know it that it is, you know. And they were pretty chilled about it, but they always had guitars around, always a piano. Nobody in that generation could actually play them, but they were there because maybe, you know, maybe one of the kids would pick them up.
And when did you first pick up or put finger to key?
I think I picked it up several times up to the age of 10, but then I think I began to fret and feel the I began to really familiarize myself with the fingerboard when I was about 12 or 13, I think. That's when it started to hit, you know.
Was there a moment of watching someone on Top of the Pops or like a poster or an album that first made you think this thing's for me?
We had an album when I was 10 called the Greatest Hits of 1985. Remember those ones?
Yeah.
There were so many good songs on that, like White Wedding was on there. The original Band Aid, Do They Know It's Christmas? And Strawberry Switchblade was on there.
Yes.
Remember that?
Yeah, I do remember all that stuff. It's totally my era.
Yeah. You Spin Me Round Like a Record.
Dead or Alive. Used to live opposite Pete Burns. Nice guy.
Really? Wow. Mm. So just, that was a brilliant year for a music introduction. And then just after that, it was Brothers in Arms, Dire Straits. That's all we wanted to listen to, really. Because of the guitar playing. It's just brilliant.
What was the first gig you went to?
Well, we used to go to things like blues jams at the volunteer pub at the top of town in Lowestoft. Probably the first one I went to where there was like local bands playing was like all the bands played at the sports centre. So it was all the bands that were just on the pub circuit. So instead of having to go to five different pubs, they were just there in the gym hall. I remember I was wearing a Depeche Mode t-shirt. Yeah, really, really tight jeans and a Depeche Mode t-shirt. Long-sleeved. It was from the Songs of Faith and Devotion record.
Nice. Was there a performance that you saw from, like a known band?
At the Sports Centre, there was a band called Bash Street Kids, who later had to change their name following an injunction from the makers of Beano's The Backstreet Kids.
That's very aggressive from the Beano.
It really was, yeah. They came swooping in as soon as they made any progress, you know. I remember looking at the guitar player, and he was brilliant, you know. I just thought, hang on a minute, I'm not far off that, you know. I could probably pull that off. I went to see Thunder, remember Thunder?
Yes, I do remember Thunder.
The UEA. And Luke Morley, still one of my favourite guitar players. And he's a left-handed player, but he was playing a white Les Paul Custom, just exactly the same as the guitars I've always played. You know? And it really, I always think that every sort of generation has a white Les Paul guy. Just about that moment, the timing was so right. You appear like a vision sent down to my life. I thought I was dreaming when I saw you that night. That's when love walked in through my door. That familiar feeling I had once before. Love walked in through my door. And it felt so strange.
Because you got good at the technical, good at the musical. That requires there's a certain kind of person that will go off when you're a kid, you know, and say, I'm now going to lock myself in my bedroom and all I'm going to do is put on...
The lock was on the outside of the door. You're dancing around the phrase nerd, aren't you?
I was dancing around the, like, has no other friends. No, but it does, like
that stings because it's true.
often the kind of popular sort of sporty kids, jocks, I guess they would be, yeah, aren't the ones that kind of find music in the same way. Were you like that? Because you can play, you know?
Well, I was able to play from about sort of 14, 15, and it got to the stage where I was having lessons as well. Like, weekly I'd have an hour lesson with a sort of blues rock guitar man. And he was getting frustrated with me because I was teaching myself hybrid picking and ignoring a lot of his plectrum stuff and teaching myself other bits, but doing it wrong, which I think is the way to establish your own voice, really, with a guitar. He was just saying, well, there's not much point in you coming here anymore. You should just go and join a band.
Who would be an artist that the kind of 15-year-old Justin Hawkins was hugely inspired by then?
That's hard to pick one. I think at that age, I was massively into The Cult, and I loved Aerosmith from when I was 12 up to, there's a period, I just love those two albums, I think, like Permanent Vacation and Pump. But not because, I don't think that the guitaring is the same as what I was trying to do or into. I just sort of couldn't understand how it was put together. It's one of those things I just listened to, and I still couldn't establish who was playing what. It's just such a brilliant production, you know. It's hard panned in a lot of places, and it's quite clear on reflection which bits are Brad Whitford and which bits are Joe Perry. But the way they mix it up, and it doesn't seem to be as the roles don't seem to be as defined as in a band like AC/DC. So there's just something magic about that. And I was listening to it all the time, just thinking, wow, that's like a wall of noise.
When did The Darkness first become The Darkness?
You can't say that it was The Darkness before 2000. It was me, Dan and Frankie, and then we had another drummer called Steve Sargent, who was brilliant, and we had another singer whose name was Paul O'Keefe, and we decided to try and gamble and find a singer that was more because I was always the guy that talked to the audience, and I was only playing keyboards and like some additional guitar, so there'd be like this disjointed voice from the side of the stage going, "How you all doing tonight? Yeah, nice to see you. Anyone in from Lowestoft? Yeah." You know, that sort of stuff. So I was always able to sort of connect with an audience, but I didn't really feel like I wanted to be a singer until the 1st of January 2000. Everyone used to talk about, as far as anybody talks about the band. But back then they used to talk about this karaoke thing, but it wasn't karaoke. It was just, I did some interpretive dance to Bohemian Rhapsody as we were celebrating New Year at my auntie's pub. And my brother was like, "Oh, it's quite obvious that you should be the singer. I don't know what your voice is going to sound like, but we'll just cross that bridge when we come to it. We'll burn that bridge when we find it." And so we started writing songs after that, really.
Because there was other musical stuff happening all around the darkness. You were kind of cutting your musical chops elsewhere, which is, I think, one of the reasons why, when it happened, you were kind of ready.
Well, my brother was doing session guitar playing, and I was writing music for TV and adverts and very, very occasionally films. Not whole scores. I did a few scenes in films.
But it's a good discipline to learn to be able to do that, isn't it?
I loved it because it's kind of like, most of the time it would be like, "Oh, there's a T-Rex song that we can't afford. Can you do something that sounds like that, but not quite, so that we don't get sued? Would that be all right?" And I was like, "Yeah, all right, great. I'll take whatever budget there is and I'll do that." So I ended up doing loads of it, like HSBC, Mars Bars. I did Tango, Glavar. I did Hard Drinks, Soft Drinks. Audi, Airbus. I did a lot of stuff where I was basically just busking for yahoo.co.uk. So you know that Yahoo, the yodeling? That wasn't me. I also did some. Because the goal for me was like to get Dan on. I wanted to improve on Dan on. You probably can't put them.
We can.
That was the grail for me, like to try and achieve Dan on.
Other yogurts are available.
And I did some stuff for the Church of England as well. And I've never really been a religious guy, but we did some reimaginings of classic hymns as kind of disco songs. And it ended up winning some prizes at the Cannes Advertising Festival. So it was kind of like we were kicking ass. You know, everything we did was landing, and it was really good fun. I just had loads of that kind of work. And then I used the fee from some IKEA ads that I'd done to pay for me and Dan to go and get some Les Pauls. Because before that, we were just playing whatever we could find, really. And then it really changed our sound, I think. It's a big moment for us. I've still got the first one I bought. And then I paid for the first record.
In the spirit of full disclosure, I have known you since just before that first EP, or just around the first EP. We used to come and see you play every week. You had a residency at the Barfly, and you'd play every Friday, and there was that. It was being at that moment when a band is ready and the audience is just discovering them, and every week there'd be more and more and more and more and more people. Mm. And it was just blatantly obvious to anybody that saw you that it was all about, it was going to happen. Mm. It whatever it is. Well, it is platinum records and private jets and huge hits. That's it, isn't it? Big, is a big gold-plated it.
Five times platinum-plated.
Five times platinum. Six now, I think. I'm just kidding.
I'm not kidding. I'm not kidding, but... But yeah, well, I mean, like being, you know, knowing that you own the record because you've just done it yourself, knowing how good it was, did you feel the confidence of, like, yeah, this is it?
I don't know if you remember, well, I mean, because we've known each other since right back then, and obviously the problem we had was, like, the perception of it in terms of where it fell on the seriousness scale. And that's because we were sort of emerging determinedly in an environment where you couldn't have anything that sort of resembled humour in your music, because people would reject it as a trick or a joke, or they'd think it was some kind of shadowy music trade businessman pulling the wool over your eyes. And because everything that we did was so preposterous, it was kind of like, it was really popular with the people that came to see it, but it was just not deemed signable by, you know, didn't fit into anybody's roster from the major labels, really. And it was very difficult to find somebody who would take a punt on it. We went out to America and we kind of thought that would be where we'd end up, really.
Really?
Yeah. But then the South by Southwest show was an unmitigated disaster.
Why? What was so bad about it?
It's that thing where, like, it's all hired gear. It's all new stuff. It's all exciting. Right. And you have, like, I'd built it up in my mind. Like, I thought it was going to be triumphant, like every Friday is at the Monarch. And that's, you're up against it with the Monarch anyway. Like, when you're playing there, there's a lot of variables and things that can go wrong. You're literally in the audience's face. You could very well get glassed or something like that. Anything could happen, you know. And I felt like we'd sort of prepared ourselves for every eventuality by playing in front of, like, that audience, and also, like, around the country where people just don't know who we are. We've done all that. We've put the work in, put the miles in. And then we went to America and none of the higher gear worked in the way we thought it was going to. The sound was completely atrocious. Most of the people had their backs to us. It was really difficult. And like, one of the first, my first sort of experience of a disdain, really, in an audience. But even then we were dividing people. Like, it just seemed like people were making their feelings known. These are music trade people. You can't expect them to sort of wholeheartedly go, yeah, this is for me, you know. I'll sign that for a dollar, whatever it was, what they were going to say. I would have signed that as well, actually, at the time. So we had, like, weirdly, Mary Gormley from Atlantic Records saw the show and was like, yeah, I'm up for this. This sounds great. But the rest of the things that we were expecting to happen didn't happen. And then we realised that we would have to do it on our own. You know, that's actually the moment where we went, okay, well, let's go make an album. Yeah.
Going to what year was the very strange Band Aid reversion?
I think that must have been
2004, Band Aid 20. Yeah,
that's it.
With that, and there was, on paper, it was a good thing. Nigel Godrich, Tom York, Danny Goffey, Macca. It felt like a good thing.
Yeah,
but it was a very weird day. I'd forgotten about the Tonight, Thank God It's Them line debacle. Yeah. Yeah. What do you remember about that?
I remember singing it and smashing it. I went in there and spanked it. And I gave it some of my own stuff on the end. I didn't just copy Bono. I went for it.
Because then the myth is, and it's all about the myths and legends, that Bono, who wasn't going to do it because he was on a holiday in Mustique or something, got a last-minute private jet back to the studio just to sing that line. Yeah. Is that not the case?
No, that's not what happened.
Oh!
No, it was... I love Bono. I really do.
Oh, I've got no issues with Bono.
I met him, and he's one of my favourite singers anyway, but just like I met him at when we inducted Queen into the Hall of Fame, which is a whole nother story. But, he was there, and I loved him. Like I wanted to introduce him to my bookkeeper at the time, who was, you know, U2 was a band that really meant a lot to her, you know. So I dragged her backstage to go and meet him. And then when I met him, she really held it together and I went to pieces. I just love him. But in this instance, it was like, that's the line that you want in that song. You know,
yeah, that's the line you want.
I was there, really. That's the line. It's amazing. And because of the solid work that he'd done back then, you know. So the new version was in the same key as the old version. I went in, I smashed it. There's no question about it. It was, and you know, but obviously mine isn't the face you want to see singing that one. I understand that. Now, I didn't at the time. But everybody had gone for it. I think Robbie had gone for it as well.
And so they passed it round a little bit.
Well, it's just that everybody probably contributed that line. I mean, I think probably did his remotely. I don't think Bono cared. He's made his point with that line.
He's done it.
Yeah, I mean, he is the iconic, that's the voice, you know?
Yeah.
So when I did it, I tried to sort of do it my way and went screaming off at the end. Maybe that was where it went right. But, you know. But, you know, I think you're obliged to put your own thing on it. That's the whole point. But I think it was actually like Bono's people, as it were, who didn't like the idea of him not doing that line.
Oh.
So at one point they'd even flown in the original recording of his line. And I was like, well, hang on, guys. If we're going to do it, have him sing it. You know, like, he should sing it. It's missing the point to actually take the existing vocal from there. Yeah. I think Bono agreed with that, and he did a reimagining of that line. But it is his line, and if he's involved in it, it should be him that sings it, really.
Yeah.
But it was on the... It was up for grabs, so I did it, and then it wasn't up for grabs. You know what I mean?
I just want to hear a version of just everybody doing that line, just a song that's just that line, but done by, like, 18 different people all having a pop in it.
No, I do now. I'll tell you how much I've changed as a musician. When I play that song now, I'll stop and I'll let the crowd do it.
Of course.
It's the gift that keeps on... taking.
It's Christmas time. There's no need to be afraid. At Christmas time, we let in light and we banish shame.
And in our world of plenty, we can spread a smile of joy. Throw your arms around.
That was Do They Know It's Christmas by Band Aid 20, featuring a whole cornucopia of special guests, including my guest on the first time this week, Justin Hawkins from The Darkness. And we'll be back to hear more about his own Christmas hit, Christmas Time, Don't Let the Bells End, right after the Six Music News.
Six Music. BBC Radio, Six Music.
Now, we're at the BBC News at 1:30. I'm Jason Kay. Merseyside police are searching for a murder suspect after a woman was shot dead at a pub in the Wirral last night. Officers said a number of others were also injured in the shooting at the lighthouse in Wallasey Village. Three foreign aid organisations are suspending all their work in Afghanistan after women were banned from working at humanitarian agencies in the country. CARE, the Norwegian Refugee Council, and Save the Children have said they couldn't do their work effectively without their female staff. Seema Samar, a former Minister of Women's Affairs now living outside Afghanistan, called on the international community to react strongly.
Every possible pressure should be put on the Taliban in order to revoke this. It's the question of not only women access to education or work, all the rights of the woman, including the right to movement, the right to choose their profession. These are also basic rights. I mean, this situation is really terrible.
King Charles has greeted well wishes after attending his first Christmas service at Sandringham as monarch. He and Camilla, Queen Consort, were joined by the Prince and Princess of Wales and other senior royals at the Norfolk estate. It's the first time the family have spent Christmas at Sandringham House since 2019. The radio presenter Kirsty Young has spoken about being diagnosed with chronic pain conditions, which led her to take a four-year break from presenting. She stepped down from Desert Island Discs in 2018 after finding out she had fibromyalgia and rheumatoid arthritis. Appearing as a guest on today's episode, she recalled her immediate reaction to the diagnosis.
It was very real. It was said with extreme kindness, much better than than I've just preceded it. But it was just a moment of absolute reality and clarity. And I remember I pulled my car over and just had a good old, well, to use a good Scottish word, good old greet about it. And I thought, right, well, them's the facts, and you're really going to have to think about this.
A newspaper in Saudi Arabia has published a special Christmas edition. It's believed to be the first publication of its kind in the Islamic country. Here's our Arab Affairs editor, Sebastian Usher.
Merry Christmas reads the headline on the front page of the English language Arab News. Beneath the seasonal illustration of reindeer pulling a sleigh across the sky above the Saudi capital, Riyadh, a story on the front page reads, Saudis feel Christmas spirit like never before. This may well be true, as a tacit ban on public expressions of any religion other than Islam has been relaxed in recent years. Other festivities that were once frowned upon in the kingdom, such as Halloween and Valentine's Day, are now celebrated, but it's not been matched by any opening up of political debate or opinion.
The Spurs manager Antonio Conte has suggested he'll rest players involved in the World Cup for tomorrow's Premier League clash with Brentford. He's already said the French goalkeeper Hugo Lloris and Argentina's Christian Romero won't be playing. Conte says that those players, the players who didn't go, are in better condition than those who did. That's 6 Music News, more at 2:30.
BBC Radio
6 Music.
I'm Matt Everett, and you're listening to The First Time, where my guest this week is singer and frontman of The Darkness, Justin Hawkins. You just heard the band's very first release, Get Your Hands Off My Woman, from February 2003, eventually featured on their colossally successful debut album, Permission to Land. Let's dive back into our conversation when I asked Justin about the first time he felt famous.
One of the sort of barometers for success is invariably money, whether you like it or not. You know, we were working really hard and not seeing any money. Like, obviously it wasn't about money, but there was a time when we all sort of individually desperately tried to get our last tenner out of the bank to go and have some, go and buy some breakfast cereal to be your only meal for the forthcoming week, you know. And then finding like a hell of a lot more money in there than you expected.
All right, you had that.
And it was because we'd had a PRS payment that was based on performance royalties, and we'd had songs on the radio, and stuff was, you know, because the momentum of the thing was clear and it was going, but we didn't have any advances from record labels. We had nothing to float the businesses. We were just really by the skin of our teeth and by the seat of our pants, just trying to do touring with our mates as techs. I was driving the van. It was really all hands on deck. And then suddenly we went to the ATMs and it was like, I'm just taken aback by how I've never seen that much money before in my life, you know. And I did a Mars bars campaign. It was a radio campaign.
The first hit. I could say Growing on Me, but that was like,
I think you could have to include that.
Number 11, not top 10, but you know. And then and then you have I Believe in a Thing Called Love, which is just, which flew, which absolutely flew. Do you remember that first coming out and people's reaction to it? Because there wasn't a lot of cynicism at that point. I don't remember. There was a lot of joy in it.
The people who were sort of doubting whether it was signable were actually, they got that wrong actually. And I often hear people complaining about the major label experience, but I loved it. I absolutely loved it, because it was like, I think by the time we got to that point, we were aware, having done our own campaign, that when you sign a record deal, that isn't the goal. You know, that's not the objective. That's actually when the real work starts.
Absolutely.
And I'm glad we had like the long struggle before that, because we were prepared for that. That's actually the bit that surprises people, I think, or used to anyway. You think it's all helicopters and champagne and stuff. And yeah, it is that. But I mean, there's also like there's a bit of a slog to it as well, which we were ready for, you know. So that's I think that's why for that year, starting with the tour with Def Leppard and ending with like our Christmas song, I would say we worked every day. We didn't say no to a single thing that they gave us. And I think we had a great relationship with Atlantic. And then moving forwards, we had the clout and the, you know, the muscle of a huge label behind us to do all the things that we wanted to do. It was awesome.
Going to ride around Wembley Arena on a sparkly white tiger?
My outfit was sparkly.
Right.
You know.
In my mind, there was a sort of suspended, sort of flying giant white tiger with you atop it, sort of circling the roof of Wembley.
I was flying over the audience in a spangly costume that was made by Christian Dior on a white tiger doing guitar solos.
But you'd earned it.
Feeling like £100, you know. And then got to the end. The first time we did that, I was like, I got on the Tiger and it was Nottingham Arena. That was the first, my debut as a flying arena rock man. And I got on there and then it took off and I was like, here we go, watch this. And I started my guitar solo and it just nothing. And I was stuck on this, stuck on the Tiger. We went over the audience all the way around. It was pretty excruciating. I was just obliged to wave and, hi guys, how's it going? And then they brought me a spare guitar, which did work. And then I said, okay, take a back round, lads. And
do it again.
So we went back in reverse. So the first time I did it, I was actually playing a solo on a white tiger over an arena audience in reverse. They said it couldn't be done.
looking now. Let me look into the sun goes down.
You mentioned the Christmas song. It's a Christmas show. Let's talk about Christmas time. Don't let the bells end. Because it's a tricky thing, Christmas songs. Yeah. You know, it's like you don't get to decide what a Christmas song is. Like the world decides if a song is going to enter that kind of pantheon. And there's the sort of rarefied air of the Pogues and Kirsty MacColl, like that's just the Untouchables. And then there's a good solid sort of first division. Mm. You know, and then there's loads under there.
This is the reason why we did it, is a testament to the relationship with Atlantic. And why am I so pro Atlantic at the moment?
Thanks, you're very much.
I don't know, it's like the least punk. Because they just said to us, all right, lads, this is brilliant. It's going really well. What do you want to do next? And we sort of laughingly said Christmas song. And then they went, yeah, all right. I'm like, okay, cool.
This is a point when you get that level of success that you had, no one's going to say no to anything.
Yeah, more than that, they'll facilitate your every whim. They went and got a list of producers, a list of engineers, and a list of studios, and it was we chose Bob Ezrin, Cento Townsend, and Abbey Road. And then we just thought, there's three dreams here. Should we make all of them come true? Yeah, all right. And it was really funny because it was like end of the summer when we recorded it. And I remember, so the first day it was us and Bob and Cenzo, Abbey Road. We did all the sort of the backing track and did my vocals. We actually did the whole thing in a day. But then the next day, Bob Ezrin was recording The Children, which is one of the reasons why we wanted to use him, is because of School's Out, Another Brick in the Wall, and his experience with making children's choirs that sound rock and roll. And also he did all the chromatic percussion, like all the bells and sleigh bells and everything, on the day that we weren't there. And the day that we weren't there, we were going to collect a load of Kerrang awards. So we turned up for the third day at Abbey Road with, like, I don't know how to describe this hangover. A hangover that changed us. It was one of those moments that, not the night itself, but the experience of having to do something the next morning changed us all.
Was it Douglas Adams that said, like, oh, this is the mother of all hangovers and she's got kids and they're coming too?
Yeah, it was like that. We got in there and Ed, our drummer, was always like a real purist. Like, he'd be like, oh, I don't really want to play to a click, but, you know, I'll play to a click. All right, so, and, you know, any sort of tempo guidance or cheating in the recordings, he didn't like that. He was like, can I just play a bar and then you just loop it? I don't know if I can keep it together. He wanted to run off and be sick, you know. It was amazing.
Oh,
remember the lead up to the second record, the atmosphere changed.
Yeah.
And I don't know, what do you remember about that and how you feel about that shift? Because the record's now, like, is rightly regarded as a really good record.
You think so?
I think so.
It's the thing about that second record is, like, it took a lot out of us to actually get it done, I think. And what we should have done, really, is probably had a year off, I think. Mm. We were that sort of... We were used to chasing momentum. Without the time off, you end up with a sort of bitterness about it, and it's just... And that makes you unrelatable. We had that whole thing of some people wanted to knock us down, some people wanted to celebrate us. We had our fan base that was growing. I know, we just didn't take a moment to reflect on what we've been doing and think about how we wanted to keep it going, really. The most important thing in a band is the relationships, you know. These are the people that you love, and they're your teammates and your family. Literally, in this instance, you know. And it was kind of like none of us were communicating properly because we were pretty sick of the sight of each other. And I think that's the recipe for fractured and tense communication with the people you love.
Yeah, this is. I think you look at lots of musicians, really successful musicians, and they've got coping methods. Mm-hmm. You know, I think you've got to learn how to cope with being front center with everybody cheering and performing, and also just not doing that because you're the same person, but you've got that split's difficult to manage, I guess.
It was always that, you know, that people say, oh, you know, I'm your real friend and I like you for who you are. And I'd be like, yeah, I'm Justin Hawkins from the darkness. Yeah, of course you do. Because I just became it. You know, for me, it was like method acting. I'm really thinking of that, you know, because like anything that's superfluous to the existence of being an actual rock star, I just threw it away. It meant throwing away friends and, you know, less self-destructive behaviours. Don't need any of those. You know, I was living it 24 hours a day, you know. I was properly living it. And I used to read, like, a lot of stories that were supposed to be rock and roll stories. And I was thinking, that's amateur night, you know. Come on, guys. You know?
Was the first time when you thought I've lost a grip on this?
It's like, because it manifests itself in lots of different ways. There's a lot of behaviours that I think are manageable, but there's some where the buck stops and then it informs everything else. There's definitely some things I could have lived without, really. And it's a shame, but the negativity is the thing that saves you in the end. You know, something terrible happens and then that's it. And it's got to be a private moment, really, because I think, like, when it's never just one thing, but there's one thing that's worse than everything else, and it's like, oh, okay, this is, then you finally recognize which direction it's going, and then you stop. So that's what happened to me. I did that. I stopped in 16 years ago, yeah, 16 and a half years ago. And
well done.
Thank you. Not that anybody's counting, you know, but I think it took me about 6 or 7 years to start enjoying my life again. That came back slowly, and no coincidence it came back at the same pace and gait, had the same gait and cadence and pace as my relationship with my brother. So as we started to sort of rebuild and get to know each other again, then I started to enjoy music.
Yeah, I mean, you know, left the band.
Yeah. But in my defence,
please,
I'd say my choices were leave the band or die. I don't know if that's dramatic enough for you, but
that's pretty dramatic. Probably,
you know, because the day I stepped into rehab, I knew I was never going to drink or do drugs again. Mm. I just knew that, I'd damaged all the relationships in that organisation that mattered, and I needed to get myself sorted so I could repair them. I actually knew it was a long undertaking. I knew that we'd get back together at some point.
Did you?
Yeah, I couldn't put a timeline on it though. I wouldn't be able to say, oh, don't worry, guys, just give me a couple of years off. I wouldn't be able to say 5, 6. I just knew that there'd, at a non-specific time in the future, I'd want to do it again.
But yeah. What was that first rehearsal like when you rejoined?
It's not that it wasn't there wasn't trust, but I think it was like we had this long period where we went from being at each other's throats to being conflict averse, and it's almost the same problem.
Okay, yeah, I see, yeah.
You know, so like...
No, that's fine. Yeah, I like that. If you want to do that, that's...
Yeah, if you want to do that, fine. You do you. But, you know, nobody really taking the bull by the horns and kicking the stuff into shape like it needed to, which is what needs to happen, I think. You know, it might not be the same person on every track, for example, but at some point, you do have to upset the apple cart to be able to get good musical results. And I think it probably took us a couple of records before we started doing that. I think I became more happy, and I love this question of happiness because I know that every day we experience the full spectrum of emotions. But within music, I sort of became more kind of satisfied when we started arguing again.
And then you've got this kind of moment where the audience really wanted you back, and then it builds all around Europe, all around the world again. Mm-hmm. Has it kind of been a lovely thing to witness?
Yeah, it's been a slow clamber up. But we're quite happy because it's like it's a cult audience, you know. We're not doing Coldplay numbers or even Early Darkness numbers. We're not doing that. But we've got an opportunity to be in arenas again in January, February in the UK. And that's actually like, that's a big moment for us.
Yeah.
You know, that's really important.
When did you first meet Taylor Hawkins? Because that show, or those shows, the tribute shows, were, you're not going to get shows like that anymore. It's very rare shows like that happen. Yeah, it was very special, and it was... The most tragic thing about it was clearly like it was the greatest show. The person that would have enjoyed that show the most wasn't there.
Yeah. Well, I met Taylor 2009, I want to say. And back then, there's a family in Ireland that were claiming to be the missing link between our families. So we had a discussion about whether or not we might be distant cousins. No, he's been a friend since like 13, 14 years or something like that. And Rufus Taylor is our drummer. He's been our drummer for a while now. But Taylor was his godfather. So he was at all of our shows. And whenever he was around.
And what do you remember from that gig?
Not just the gig itself. There was a week leading up to it where we were all holed up in the same hotel, all rehearsing, trying to make it work. And it was an amazing environment because there's so many people around that I respected and loved, you know, and then just being part of this thing where everybody was just fighting to make it work and giving it 100%, no egos or anything. Like, it was incredible. We all worked together, ate together, just full of love. And it was all like everybody was each other's emotional support animal. And then it gets to the main day and the first speech, everybody's crying. Not a dry eye in the house, you know, on backstage, on stage, everything. It was just, it all hit everybody at the same time, you know. And then it was like, everything was for Taylor, the whole thing. Like, all we wanted was to not have to do that show.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? Like, it was like, and you could feel that, you know, it was just, it was definitely the most powerful thing I've ever been involved in. Yeah. I was just, I was just glad that Dan was there. You know, Dan didn't take part in the Wembley stuff, but we had a good cry afterwards.
Yeah. Let's end on a Christmas song, Justin. What should we finish on and why?
I'm probably going to go with A Cliff, Mistletoe and Wine.
Okay, go on.
It's because of that bit that goes like this.
Go on.
Christmas time, mistletoe and wine, children sing Christian rhyme.
Then there's the logs on the fire.
Yeah.
Gifts on the tree. Time to rejoice in the good news. And then it goes,
Christmas time.
Just love that bit. Not sure if that's Cliff doing it, actually, but...
You seem to be really, really enjoying... That's just reminding me, just the plan. You seem to be really enjoying doing the little song breakdown to becoming... You're a YouTuber now, man.
I am a YouTuber.
Yeah.
Like, would have it. It's a different kind of connection with our audience, really. I've had a lot of people saying, like, oh, been watching your YouTube and it's brought me to the darkness, and in a good way, you know. And then they sort of, like, I'm getting stopped in airports and people shaking my hand and stuff. And that hasn't happened since, like, before I disgraced myself.
That's really sweet, though. That's brilliant.
Like, now, these days I get, oh, sorry at the Taylor shows, and I love your YouTube. It's the way it goes, isn't it? But now they can see us in arenas next year, so boom.
Exactly. It's been lovely to speak to you.
It's always a pleasure.
And it's nice. Let's do it again.
Yeah. Next Christmas.
It's a time for giving, a time for getting, a time for forgiving and for forgetting. Christmas is love, Christmas is peace, a time for hating and fighting to cease.
That was Cliff. Of course it was. With Mistletoe and Wine. The final choice of my guest on the first time this week, Justin Hawkins. And a huge thank you to Justin for joining us today. And the Darkness are back where they belong, playing a UK arena tour, kicking off at the end of January in Cardiff, taking in Liverpool, Glasgow, Birmingham, Manchester, Leeds, and ending up at Wembley Arena on February the 4th. And that is the end of this week's show. Head to the BBC Sounds app to catch up with more episodes from this series, including my chats with Phoenix, Shebaga Hutchins, Sandy Gold, Brian Johnson of AC/DC, and loads more. We'll be back in February with a brand new series. Until then, from me and the First Time team, Happy Christmas. My name has been Matt Everett. Thanks for listening.